Welcome. I'm Eric Fleming, host of A Moment with Eric Fleming, the podcast of our time. I want to personally thank you for listening to the podcast. If you like what you're hearing, then I need you to do a few things. First, I need subscribers. I'm on Patreon at patreon.com/A Moment with Eric Fleming. Your subscription allows an independent podcaster like me the freedom to speak truth to power and to expand and improve the show. Second, leave a 5-star review for the podcast on the streaming service you listen to it. That will help the podcast tremendously. Third, go to the website, momenteric.com. There you can subscribe to the podcast, leave reviews and comments, listen to past episodes, and even learn a little bit about your host. Lastly, don't keep this a secret like it's your own personal guilty pleasure. Tell someone else about the podcast. Encourage others to listen to the podcast and share the podcast on your social media platforms, because it is time to make this moment a movement. Thanks in advance for supporting the podcast of our time. I hope you enjoy this episode as well. Hello, and welcome to another moment with Eric Fleming. I am your host, Eric Fleming. And today, I have a couple of guests on that's going to talk about resilience and empowerment. Both of these ladies are emblematic, symbolic, a great representation of those two themes. And I hope that y'all will pick up on that during the interviews. I am really honored to have them come on. And again, I look forward to y'all's feedback on how you felt those interviews went. So, without any further ado, ladies and gentlemen, it's time for A Moment of News with Grace G.
Thanks, Eric. A federal court reinstated a South Carolina electoral map, which was previously thrown out due to bias against black voters for the current year's congressional elections. Crystal Mason, who was sentenced for illegal voting in Texas, was acquitted by an appeals court after a higher court's order to review the case. Robert F. Kennedy Jr., an independent presidential candidate, chose technology attorney Nicole Shanahan as his vice presidential running mate. President Joe Biden, joined by Barack Obama and Bill Clinton, held a fundraiser which raised over $25 million for Biden's re-election campaign. A federal court in Texas, favored by conservatives, will not adhere to a new policy meant to prevent judge shopping in cases challenging federal or state laws. The U.S. government has rapidly allocated $60 million to Maryland for cleanup and construction after the Francis Scott Key Bridge collapse. President Biden condemned Russia for detaining Wall Street Journal reporter Evan Gershkovich, marking 1 year since his arrest on spying charges. The Republican-controlled U.S. House of Representatives will send 2 articles of impeachment against Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas to the Senate on April 10th. Former New Jersey Governor Chris Christie has declined to run for president as a no-labels candidate. Wisconsin Governor Tony Evers vetoed a bill that would restrict transgender and intersex children from playing on sex-segregated sports teams. A California judge recommended disbarment for John Eastman, Trump's former lawyer, for attempts to overturn the 2020 election results. The White House announced updated federal data collection standards on race and ethnicity, including a new category for Middle Eastern or North African identities. The FDA's proposed ban on menthol cigarettes has been delayed as the White House missed another deadline to issue a final rule. And Oscar award-winning actor Louis Gossett Jr. died at the age of 87. I am Grace G., and this has been A Moment of News.
Thank you. All right, Grace. And thank you for that moment of news. And now it's time for my first guest, Evelyn LaChapelle. In 2013, Evelyn found herself facing adversity, convicted on 3 charges related to her minor role in a marijuana distribution operation. Despite a challenging period that led to an 87-month prison sentence, Evelyn emerged stronger and determined to make a positive impact. Today, Evelyn is a driving force in the legal cannabis industry, utilizing her professional position to advocate for restorative justice. As a proud owner and founder of the Weed Lady Gift Shop and lifestyle brand, she is on a mission to normalize cannabis consumption and create opportunities for the formerly incarcerated to find their path in this evolving industry. Evelyn's journey is a powerful narrative of both defeat and victory. She is committed to pushing her brand, the Weed Lady, forward with a focus on luxury cannabis essentials, apparel, cannabis delivery, and soon-to-be-released cannabis beverages. Beyond her entrepreneurial ventures, Evelyn is the co-creator of Canna Kick It, the Bay Area's premier cannabis day party. Additionally, she is a founding member of Ladies Loving and Living, a nonprofit organization dedicated to serving women post-incarceration. In 2023, Evelyn took her passion for empowering others to the airways with the launch of her own podcast, Grind Time. This podcast serves as a behind-the-scenes look at becoming an entrepreneur, offering valuable insights and practical advice by helping listeners transform their to-do list to their did list and turning dreams into reality. Evelyn LaChapelle is not just a name, but a symbol of resilience, advocacy, and entrepreneurial spirit. Ladies and gentlemen, it is my distinct honor and privilege to have as a guest on this podcast, Evelyn LaChapelle. All right. Evelyn LaChapelle, how you doing, sister? You doing good?
I'm doing good. Thank you for asking.
Well, thank you for coming on the podcast. You know, one of the cool things since I've been doing the guest thing is, you know, connecting with people on LinkedIn and just checking out their stories, right? And I've had some people on dealing with the issue with legalization of marijuana. And I actually do have a guest committed to come on that's going to give the opposite position. And that's one thing I try to do on this podcast is try to give both sides and let the people decide how they feel about it. But your story is a little different. And it's actually an angle that, you know, touching on it with certain people, they've never experienced what you've experienced. So I wanted you to come on from that perspective and talk about that. But before we get into that, one of the things I do is that I ask guests to respond to a quote. And it's either something they may have said, something they may have written, or something related to the work. So this is your quote. "We are living among many people who were previously incarcerated and are walking and carrying lots of shame and lots of guilt because of it. And I would just ask that people soften their heart and their language. You just don't know who you're sitting with." What does that quote mean to you?
I don't know that I would have been able to transition from prison back home had I not spent time the last maybe 9 months of my incarceration working on shame and guilt with listening to and learning the teachings of Brené Brown, who is like shame and guilt guru. Sorry about the dog. I hope it's not interrupting us.
No, we're good.
But shame and guilt was certainly something that I had to work on coming home from prison. it stands out for me. Being a former inmate and just being a parent carries a lot of shame and guilt. For instance, I was at a softball game yesterday, and there's a parent that gives my daughter a ride home after practice that I hadn't met yet. And so this is my first time meeting him. But before I even knew who he was, he had on his corrections hoodie. And so he's a prison corrections officer. And immediately, I feel a little shame for my daughter, right? Because where I'm very vocal and open about my incarceration, about my prison sentence. Her friends maybe follow me on Instagram, so they're very open about it. And now I'm in the car with the corrections officer, who I am assuming has very different views on legalization, the criminalization of it. And so there's still a tinge of shame left, but with all of the work that I do, it's really to help myself and others sort of come over that hurdle. There's a lot of people in prison that don't belong there. There's a lot of, I spent most of my time in a prison camp, so I was in there with a bunch of Martha Stewarts. And so it's not even the imagery that folks have of who's in a prison camp. Lots of grandmothers, aunties, lots of folks in there because they filed their taxes wrong or their husbands did some illegal banking. And it's just, shame is there for sure. And so what that quote just said, it's just recognizing that. And it's in so many other things. So we're navigating this as a community that doesn't have a voice. As a community that's not seen, you can't see my felony from the outside. I've been unemployed for almost a year, and like part of what's keeping me from continuing to seek employment is the shame of having to like address that with another professional. And so it's really what landed me into entrepreneurship. If you think of, like, if I think about it, it's the shame that sort of pushed me into becoming an entrepreneur.
So let's talk about the journey. You were a college student, and so let's go from how you were a college student to now being an activist and an entrepreneur. Let's fill in the blanks a little bit.
What a journey. I will I went to the University of Loyola Marymount in Los Angeles, and I was going to study theater. And my dad was like adamant, like, no, study business. And so I studied business with an emphasis in entrepreneurship. It was in my heart. I learned a lot. The school is great. They're known for the entrepreneurship program. So I know I the information said in there, but it wasn't something that I was seeking. I used to actually blame my dad for like, I wanted to be an actress, and you made me go to business school. But we always learn life in hindsight, right? So he saw something that I didn't see and that I was going to need this later. And so while I was in college, I allowed a friend who ended up becoming my co-defendant to deposit his income into my bank account. And that income was coming from the sale of cannabis. And so this was during my third year in college. I literally, it lasted for 9 months. From January to September, he had deposits come in. After September, I sort of moved on with my life. Graduated from university, moved back home in the Bay Area, and then was arrested for those funds that I let him deposit into my account. Spent 5 years, received a 7-year sentence, spent 5 years in custody, 2.5 years on probation. Got a job, doing what I do, which is event catering, coordinating for the hotels. I intended on climbing that corporate ladder all the way to like executive at the hotels in hospitality. And somebody Googled my name, realized I was a felon, and I got fired. And that's it. Like, you're not gonna fire me twice. So I was like, and now it's time to be an entrepreneur and own my own future. And I realized something that I wish I would have realized a long time ago. But no one's coming to save you. And I think that is the piece that pushes entrepreneurs out of their comfort zone. It was like realizing Corporate America doesn't want me. I've just lost 5 years to the prison system. Get up and do something. So.
So, how hard was it for you to make the transition back to society, and what was the opportunity? So, you said that, for example, that you had a good job, somebody found out that you had a record, and you lost that job. So, what was the opportunity to get you into the legal cannabis industry?
Yeah, I was actually very blessed. Extremely blessed that there was a pathway ahead of me. And I say that it's a real blessing because so many people come home and they won't get these blessings. And so I don't want what I hate for is people to look at me and say, look, she did it, she made it, and then judge the people that didn't. No, like I just was in the right room, with the right appearance and the right articulation, and it was a blessing. But when I came home, I was connected with an organization that was advocating for cannabis inmates, and they asked me to speak at a fundraiser that they were having, and so I spoke. And once I got off the stage, there was an company in the audience called Virtosa that they manufacture the emulsions that go into making cannabis products, topicals, edibles, or beverages. So they turn that oil into a water-soluble solution. And just off hearing my story, they were like, we need to give you a job. I think I had just got fired too. So I told everyone how I got fired. And they were like, what do you do? And I was like, sales and catering is what I do. And so they made me their community engagement manager up into the pandemic, planning all of their, events, conferences, happy hours, internal, external events. And that was my first paid position in the regulated industry, and it just blew my mind. Like, I'm straight out of prison and I'm in here with the CEO, CEO. They have their whiteboard out and they're talking about sales in numbers of pounds and pounds of weed. And I know for sure at this point that there are still people sitting in life for this plant. And so it just blew my mind to see the suits and ties trading this plant, and so many of my co-defendants were still locked up.
That's one of the things that this sister Michelle Alexander had talked about, and that there was this movement when the movement really started nationwide to legalize cannabis, because it had been a movement for a long time, but it just started picking up momentum, and then with Colorado's success story, it really kind of took off. And so, one of the things that she was saying was that all these states that are thinking about it, there needs to be members of the legislature to say, okay, so part of this deal in legalizing it is that we need to let these people out that have been charged with it in some way, shape, or form. So that was kind of one of my questions. It was like, if I was still in the legislature and we had a bill to legalize marijuana and expunge the records of people convicted of simple marijuana possession, what would you say to me to convince me to support that legislation?
I would first say that simple possession is not enough. If we were legalizing this plant and we could all grow it freely, happily, and enjoy it, and possession of it is the only thing that you are making, that you are criminalizing, fine. But to a legislator or to the president who continues to only want to pardon or expunge folks for simple possession, I don't think it's enough when this country is set to, when this industry, I think, is set to be over a $30 billion industry by 2027. It's traded on the global stock exchange and it was deemed essential during a global pandemic, when all the restaurants are shut down, when you can't get into the stores, the dispensaries remained open, and those folks continued to rack in millions of dollars that support our states through taxes, then simple possession really only clears up those people who got arrested and convicted for smoking, which is just rare. Most folks are selling weed, and that's what they're getting arrested for. And if you got picked up for simple possession, in order to make the charges stick, they most likely added other charges, intent to sell, right? My crime was allowing those funds to be deposited into my bank account. That's a money laundering charge. That's not even a cannabis, related charge. So those provisions don't really assist the people who were charged for operating in this industry pre-regulation. And so that's what I say to simple possession. And then to this notion that before a state legalizes, that this should be written into the policy. I've said it 1,000 times. I think the cannabis industry has enough buying power. We bring enough taxes to the states that legalize that it really should be a demand. It should be the cannabis industry won't even operate in this state or consider legalization in this state until you release the men and women who are still incarcerated. The problem is the incarcerated population is completely unheard and unseen, and it leaves the average civilian to think that with legalization came retroactive legislation for the inmates, and it didn't. Like so many people think that once they legalize, those people are free. And I all am often surprising people that there are still people serving life. Parker Coleman is still serving a 60-year sentence for nonviolent cannabis offense. So I, to the politicians, you're not doing enough.
Yeah, that and that's good. That's good because it's like you're basically saying, "Look, sir, we need you to amend the legislation," and trust me, those kind of conversations happened a lot where it's like, "Yeah, we're glad that you're supporting the concept, but this is what we really want." So that's
Right.
good, and that's something that needs to be
Right.
really, really articulated from activists like you. Talk about your work with Ladies Loving and Living.
Yes, that is my newest baby, Ladies Loving and Living. So that is an organization that I started with two other women, Natalia Wade and Carly Kramer, all three of us incarcerated for cannabis, and all three of us realizing that the prison system, the reentry system, the second chances, all of these programs for the most part are geared towards men. Right. We'll train you in a trade. We'll get you forklift trained, like all of this work and all of these resources that are geared towards men. We wanted to fill in the gap. Ladies Loving and Living is literally the opposite of ladies riding and dying, that culture that continues to get us wrapped up in this system of like, ride or die. And so we want to encourage women to love and live. And so our program, the organization is a three-part program. It has the lady care packages so that when women are transitioning into the halfway house, they are greeted with a welcome home package, which for me meant the world. I had a friend in San Diego who sent a box, and it had a blow dryer, a flat iron, some pajamas, pillowcases, like just to restore the dignity of all of the things that are stripped from you in prison as a woman. Like you can't even comb your hair as a woman. And so the care packages is the first greeting them home with that, and then wanting to transition or at least offer the ladies the opportunity to create their own income. So we have the ladies entrepreneurial programming, which we provide grants for the women to start their own small micro businesses through vending machines or ATMs. So They have to do the work of finding the location for these machines. We'll provide the grant, and we will also offer training on how to keep the, your cost of goods down, how to maintain your inventory, how to keep open communication with your vendor locations. And then there's the Lady Wellness Program, because going to prison, you lose a lot, and you lose that loss comes in so many different levels. Like, I lost a parent, you're losing years with your children, you're losing, for me, my career. Like, I really thought that my career was going to be in hospitality. I lost that. I don't want to put this out in the air, but I went in at 28. I'm 40 now. I really feel like I lost the opportunity to have more children. So there's like levels to the loss. And so creating programs that allow women to grieve that loss, to really come to terms with what you've lost, and then to start looking forward to your future. And so that's Ladies Loving and Living.
Well, I'm glad you put that out there, because one of the things that there's a couple of things I want to ask you specifically about your program. What kind of support do you have for women who are transitioning back and, and trying to reestablish relationships with their children? Do y'all have a support mechanism? Is that something y'all working on? And then the other question I wanted to ask was about, since this is a political show, about voting. And I don't know what the laws are in California about getting their voting rights back once they've been incarcerated. So are you getting into those areas as well?
It is our intention. So right now, we haven't been able to supply support in the terms of rebuilding families. We are still like heavily fundraising. Our hygiene bags at retail value are like $500 a piece, and we're just starting our fundraising campaign. And side note, even it has been slowed down because the founders are felons, and so our bank account has been closed just off of the we're felons, right? And so even wanting to do good work has been blocked in many ways. But to speak to the family transition, I mean, what a huge transition that is from going to being a prison mom to an in-person mom. And I've been home for 5 years now, and I am 100% sure that that needs to come with professional counseling transitioning. And I haven't even had the opportunity to afford that. And so there will be a point where it will be my focus to make that affordable for parents and children. Because raising a teenage daughter is enough. Raising a teenage daughter who you left, and went to prison. And they, for me, I believe I had become the fun mom. Like, my daughter would visit me in prison, and we're eating snacks out of the vending machines and playing Battleship for hours. And we did that for years. And then I came home, and she quickly learned, mom cares about my homework. She cares about what I'm eating. She likes to fuss, right? And so it's a real transition for kids. And if you're not careful, there's resentments that are built and maybe a level of manipulation, right? Like, you went to jail and you left me. So all of these things that need to be addressed. And voting, I am a federal felon. And so my first voting round, when I came home, I thought I couldn't vote. And my mom had just watched something where the lady had went to jail for voting as a felony. So she like freaked out. You are not voting. You can't vote. So I was like, you're right. I'm not going to vote. But I learned that as a federal felon, even on probation, you could vote because you're not considered in custody. So there's a lot of misinformation. And so, yes, absolutely. Ladies Loving and Living will be a resource for the correct information. We actually just connected with CORE, which is in Alameda County here in California, reentry service through probation. And so it's a direct line to all the up-to-date current information for the ladies that come through the program.
Yeah, that's that, you know, that both of those components to me are very, very important. I don't know if you had a chance to even check into me, but you know, like I said, I was a former state legislator, and when I got elected, I was in law enforcement, and then, you know, I've been in law enforcement in two different states. But one of the main issues when I was a legislator was in Mississippi. You literally have to have a bill with your name on it. So, in your case, if you had come to me and said, Representative Fleming, I need to get my voting rights back, then I would have to introduce a bill that had Evelyn LaChapelle's name on it and what you were charged with, and introduce that as a single bill. And we would get, on average, about 3,000 requests a year. And we'd be lucky to get 10, right? Because
Right.
the criteria in Mississippi is that even though the statute says the minute you get out, you can give it. But the reality is that on the House side, we want to see if you've been out for 5 years, right? And haven't gotten in any trouble. Then we send it over to the Senate. Then the Senate's going to check to see if you paid all your restitution back. And then once you've passed that test, if you can get out of committee in both of those houses and get it passed, then the governor signs it and then you get your voting rights back. So in 9 years of service, I got at least three people their voting rights back. And a lot of people are like, how'd you do that? You know what I'm saying? But fortunately, I served on the committee in the House that dealt with it. So,
Great.
you know, and one, the toughest one I had was one of the victims of a person that I was pushing through was the attorney for the committee. And the only reason why I got it passed is because he liked me and he said, well, Representative, since you're the one pushing it and you can vouch for, well, you know, I'll back off my objection and, you know, and we got it passed and she got her rights back. But yeah, so that's something that's always been important to me. And so I'm glad that you're addressing that in some kind of way. In one of your
Can
episodes, go ahead, say something.
I just wanted to add that that process just is absurd, right? And absolutely put in place to discriminate and to prevent folks from getting to the voting polls, which is just absurd. But it reminds me of the position that I'm in now of wanting to get my record clear. And the only person being able to do that is the sitting president, right? And it's like, as the president of the United States, as the House committee, as the senator, there's so many other things that you have on your plate. The world is upside down. The economy, the pandemic, just the crime here, like to put the voting rights or to put my expungement on the plate of such high officials just seems extremely counterproductive. And if I had a piece of the legislation that I would go after, or if there was a in any like I'm completely jaded by the government, and so I don't too much get involved. I don't have any faith. I don't believe in it. I do vote. I show care and concern, but I just don't have faith that the right things are going to be done. But if I had the heart to go after something, it's this piece of creating committees that are specifically for restoring the rights of former inmates because you've served your time. So all of these extra barriers, all of these extra punishments that are not included in your sentencing when you receive, you know, your sentence, that needs to be like that's ridiculous.
Yeah, it is ridiculous. And
To vote. You know, to vote. Like they're not asking for money. They just want to vote.
well, you know, and you brought up the point that the crimes that will take your votes away in Mississippi was instituted in the 1894 convention, I mean Constitution. And so they basically were looking at crimes that they thought black folks did. And said, okay, those eight crimes, because one of the crimes, which is phenomenal to me, but you know, is bigamy. If you marry more than one person, you lose your right to vote, right? So, like I said, they just thought these were the things they thought black people did.
Right.
And so, you know, and they've, and, you know, up until this date, they still haven't changed that process.
Right.
So, yeah, it's, it is ridiculous, but, you know, hopefully, and I've got good friends still in the legislature and they're fighting to try to change that process. So I'm glad that, like I said, that that's an issue that you want to tackle. Oh, the other ironic thing I wanted to say to you is that in Mississippi, if you were arrested on a drug charge in Mississippi, you don't lose your right to vote, because in 1894 that they weren't thinking like that. So it's like we got a lot of people voting absentee that were, you know, charged with possession charges or intent to sell charges and all that kind of stuff. So I just wanted to throw that aside in there. So my last question to you is this. In one of the episodes of your podcast, Grind Time, you talked about a sermon you heard concerning taking up space. Explain how taking up space is important for people struggling to make the transition from incarceration back into society.
The opposite of taking up space is shrinking. And when especially you started this podcast, this conversation off with shame, right? And so if you're carrying the burden of the shame and the guilt of your incarceration, then you are inclined to shrink. And there has been instances where I believe I am shrinking because I believe that the value of my voice and my insight because of my incarceration is diminished. And so it was a sermon, but it actually came from the Book of Clarence, a movie just produced about Timothy from the Bible. And it, the mother had encouraged her son to take up space. And it's really propelled me into speaking loudly and not, you know, not volume wise, but speaking honestly about my experience, owning the value that I bring to not only the cannabis industry, but the reentry space, and in my career of curating events, like owning your experience, owning your accomplishments as a woman, as a Black woman. We have sort of diminished our voice and have learned easily how to shrink in the crowd. And so taking up space for me just means chin up, chest out. You know, I've got it written on my mirror, chin up, chest out, walk with authority, walk like you have a purpose. Even if the purpose is not clear yet, you know, take up space, let them, my self-talk now is like, let them know Evelyn LaChapelle is in the room. And not entering spaces, trying to see who's important and who do I need to talk to? Who do I need to pitch to? Who am I needing to sell my ideas to? And, I'm more so on a, how can I add value now? How can I, when I enter the room, what am I bringing? And that's how I'm taking up space.
So if people want to get in touch with you, if people want to buy some of your products and all that stuff, this is your time to plug that. How do people reach out to you?
So my favorite way right now is YouTube on the Grind Time podcast, where every day you can get in touch with what I'm doing to create a profitable business on YouTube. You can find me on the Weed Lady channel, Grind Time podcast. I make it very easy for you to shop the gift shop. It is called theweedlady.com. You no longer have to call the weed man. You can call the weed lady. There are no THC products on the store, so no one's going to jail. It's a gift shop curated for the weed lady in your life, for the women consumers. Our mission is to normalize cannabis consumption. The brand is the Weed Lady. The message is weed is not a crime, and every purchase supports a woman formerly incarcerated for cannabis. And on Instagram, it's 87 months underscore the wee lady. 87 months is the sentence that I received for depositing cannabis profits.
All right. Well, Evelyn LaChapelle, first of all, thank you for coming on the podcast. If you would indulge me, let me encourage you. I think
Please.
That
Please.
What you are doing is so vitally important, not just for the particular issue about marijuana and its legalization and all that stuff, but it's about to transition. Because, see, I'm just like you. I believe that when you pay your debt to society, you paid it. And, you know, one of the things that, you know, I used to do a lot was when I was had work detail, and I would have inmates, and most of the guys were state inmates. And when they came to me, they were in their last year. Right. So they were working off that last little bit of time so they can get out earlier. And they would ask me questions about, you know, well, what should I do and all this kind of stuff. And the only thing that was consistent with everybody, because everybody's situation is different, but the thing is, stay focused. You know, one of my favorite quotes in the Bible from Paul is, keep pressing toward the higher mark, right? And so you are on that path to keep pressing toward a higher mark. I hope that all sorts of opportunities continue to open up for you in this space that you're in, not just from the business aspect, but from the advocacy side, because the more people, and that's why I wanted to ask you that question about taking up space, because the more people that stand up and articulate what they're going through and fighting for a change in that, the better we're going to be as a society. So I'm honored to meet you. Now that you've been a guest on the podcast, you have an open invitation to come. You say, hey, look, Eric, I need to talk about this. Let's make that happen. So again, thank you for coming on, and thank you for the work that you're in doing, and just keep pressing toward that high mark.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you for the encouragement and the insight and the scripture. You have no idea. I'm taking that with me today. So thank you. I appreciate you.
All right, guys. We're going to catch y'all on the other side. All right, and we are back. And so now my next guest is Dr. C. Nicole Mason. Recently named one of the world's 50 greatest leaders by Fortune magazine, Dr. C. Nicole Mason is president slash CEO emeritus of the Institute for Women's Policy and Research, the IWPR. Having stepped into this role in November 2019, Dr. Mason was the youngest to lead one of the major inside the Beltway think tanks in Washington, D.C., and one of the few women of color to do so. As one of the nation's foremost intersectional researchers and scholars, Dr. C. Nicole Mason brings a fresh perspective and a wealth of experience to the Institute for Women's Policy Research. For the past two decades, Dr. Mason has spearheaded research on issues relating to economic security, pay equity, poverty, women's issues, and entitlement reforms, policy formation and political participation among women and communities of color, and racial equity. Prior to IWPR, Dr. Mason was the executive director of the Women of Color Policy Network at New York University's Robert F. Wagner Graduate School of Public Service, the nation's only research and policy center focused on women of color at a nationally ranked school of public administration. She is also an inaugural Ascend Fellow at the Aspen Institute in Washington, D.C. At the start of the pandemic, she coined the term She Session to describe the disproportionate impact of employment and income losses on women. Dr. Mason is the author of Born Bright, A Young Girl's Journey from Nothing to Something in America, and has written hundreds of articles on women, poverty, and economic security. Her writing and commentary have been featured in The New York Times, MSNBC, CNN, NBC, CBS, The Washington Post, Marie Claire, The Progressive, Essence, Bustle, Big Think, Miami Herald, Democracy Now!, and numerous NPR affiliates, among others. And she is now embarking on, and that's the reason why I emphasize the word emeritus, on a new organization that she's starting, and we'll get into that in the interview. So, ladies and gentlemen, it is my distinct honor and privilege to have as a guest on this podcast, Dr. C. Nicole Mason. All right, Dr. C. Nicole Mason. How you doing, ma'am? You doing good?
I'm doing well.
Well, I am really, really honored to have you on. I had connected with you on LinkedIn, and you know, sometimes when you connect with people and you say, "Hey, this sister's doing something, I'd like to get her on the podcast," I didn't realize I was getting, like, you know, a superstar. I was just, you know, I said, this sister's doing some good work, so let me just get her on. But I'm really honored that you accepted my invitation. So thank you.
Oh, thank you for inviting me. I love podcasts and I love talking about my work. And you know, it's great. And thank you for reaching out.
All right. So normally when I do this, I try to find a quote, and it's either something that is related to the work that they're doing, something that the guest might have said, or something that they might have written. So your quote is this: when you live your life on your own terms, you have few regrets. What does that quote mean to you?
It means just that. So, when you chart your own path, when you decide what you want, regardless of what's happening outside or what people are telling you you should be or do, everything tends to work out. And you end up with a life that you've created, as opposed to a life that has been created for you, or you've been told what your limits are and what you can or cannot do or be. And you have very few regrets about that when you do it that way.
When I invited you, you were part of a particular organization, and now I understand you're not a part of that organization anymore, and you're starting a new one. So what will be the purpose and mission of Future Forward Women, the new organization that you're involved with?
So I've been doing women's advocacy work for the last two decades. I started during my time at Howard University. And since then, I've had the opportunity to be a part of and to run and lead a lot of different women's organizations. And so Future Forward Women is an opportunity for me to bring all the things that I really care about and really work to build women's power and influence. In my work, what I found is that women's advocates or women's issues, we always run into a brick wall when we're trying to get universal childcare, paid sick leave, or run for elected office. And what I've learned is that the reason why we lose or don't get what we get is that we don't have a lot of power and influence. And so really doing my part to increase women's power influence so that we can see real change.
So how did a girl living in poverty from Linwood, California, become one of the world's 50 greatest leaders?
That's a really big question, and I have a question I haven't thought about in a really long time. But I'll start by saying that it's really been about tenacity. I think grit, really having a vision for myself that I don't think I could see at the time, or when I think about my beginning, or I was raised by a teenage mom, single mom, and we really struggled to make ends meet. And even then, thinking that there had to be something else, there had to be a different way, there had to be something else for me. And I just want to say that for a little brown girl raised by a teenage single mother, the bar for my success was really low. And a lot of times people wrote me off. But my own tenacity, my own discipline, my own unwillingness to take no for an answer sort of set me on this path to where I am today. And for that, I'm really very grateful. And when I take a step back to look at how far I've come and what I've been able to contribute to the world, it's just it makes me teary sometimes. And I know that I'm on the right path.
In your book, Born Bright, you stated that you would be perceived a winner by both Democrats and Republicans, but you didn't feel like one. Expound on why you felt that way.
Well, so when you think about poverty and you think about people getting out of poverty or escaping poverty, and you can't see it, but I'm putting escaping in quotation marks, Democrats like to hold up me as an example of a person who did all the right things and, use social supports to get out of poverty and enter the middle class. And Republicans use me in a different way to say, well, if she can do it, you can do it. You're just not working hard enough. You need to pull yourself up by the bootstraps. And for me, one of the things I like to say is that I'm just one person. And so instead of asking the question about why, how it is that you made it out of poverty, I want to ask a different question, which is why haven't so many others? And I think when we ask that question, which is a different question, we can really talk about the systems and institutions and structures that keep people trapped in a cycle of poverty.
Yeah, so as one of those Democrats, I have been and continue to be an advocate for programs and like Head Start and all those other things. But I'm with you. I think the question becomes, if we say, and I'm just throwing this stat out here, if 80% of all the kids that go through Head Start end up at least being accepted to college, what's going on with the other 20? So that's always been kind of my mission as an elected official, and I'm glad that somebody like you, that's a lot smarter than me, is working on that particular aspect of the problem. And the thing that really kind of sparked me to ask that question to you, because you tell the story about how you were at a symposium and you were supposed to give a certain answer, and then you just blurted out your truth, and it was like crickets in the room. Kind of explain what you kind of articulated in the book how you felt, but looking back at it now, how has that shaped what you're trying to do?
So I think that in my work, I try to be a truth teller. I try to push the boundaries and say we need to think bigger. The solutions and strategies that we've tried haven't worked, and to be honest about that and say, okay, well, what can we do differently to get a different outcome? We might have to take apart the whole system and rebuild it. We might have to start in a different place. And I think that that makes a lot of people, especially in the work that I do, uncomfortable. because they have to expand and think differently about a problem or an issue. It might require taking resources away from a program that isn't working or a strategy that isn't working and investing in a strategy that is different, that hasn't been tried, but may really change the game, or we might really get closer to what we say we want. And from where I sit, I feel a real urgency to really be thinking about these problems differently. We understand the problem. We know, poverty has existed for more than 100 years. Many of the issues we've talked about, whether it's racism, women's rights, these issues have existed for a long time. So what might we need to change or do to get a different outcome?
All right. In the Obama administration, women made 89 cents to every dollar men made. In the Trump administration, women made 69 cents to every dollar men made. One, how should those facts impact the upcoming election? And two, how challenging is the issue of achieving gender pay equity when the White House doesn't even practice it?
Well, listen, this election, I'm going to do my part. I think we're all going to do our part, or hopefully people will show up to the polls and vote and do their parts and do their part. Eric, I don't, I think this is crazy town. Even where, the election as we see it between, Biden and Donald Trump is kind of crazy town, because the choice for me is very clear. What is pretty hard and difficult for me to swallow and sort of think about is that Trump and Biden are so close in the polls. And it makes me wonder about how we could be here as a country where we are really literally fighting for our lives, fighting for democracy. It's very clear that the rhetoric from Trump is sexist, homophobic, racist, xenophobic, and yet he's a real contender for the highest office of the land and one of the most powerful positions in the world. I find that heartbreaking, problematic, and says a little bit about where we are and who we are as a country and a people collectively.
Yeah, but
So,
what about
in terms of
the gender
the gender
pay?
pay, I know, I just now, you didn't caught me. So, when I think about the gender pay gap, it's a very insidious thing. So, the gender pay gap is only part of the issue. The gender pay gap exists because women are not in positions of power. Women don't have access to rooms of power. Women are not making hiring decisions. Women are not making workplace policies or in positions of power, whether it's in either administration. So when I think about closing the pay gap, the answer is not so simple. But one of the things that we can do to accelerate the closing of the pay gap is, one, recognize that it exists, because there's a lot of talk about whether or not it really exists, but also really start to put women in positions of power so that they are in decision-making roles, so that we can really address many of these issues, not only pay transparency, but paid sick leave, childcare issues. There's a lot of issues that get overlooked or we don't pay attention to because women are not at the decision-making tables.
So I'm gonna play devil's advocate with you on that answer. So, would we have been better off if it was a race between Kamala Harris and Nikki Haley, as far as dealing with women's issues and it being highlighted? Because, I mean, in Mexico, that's basically what happened. The top two Party candidates were females, and they did address a lot of issues pertaining to women as it relates to that country. Would women see a better outcome if they were, those two were the nominees as opposed to two old white men?
Well, so that is a really great question. So I live for the day where there are two women running for president in the United States. And so, and we're having policy debates and really deciding between the candidates based on the issues. And so that would be awesome to see. However, if there's a woman who's running for president who in policy and thinking and her orientation is anti women's issues or lines up on in the same way on policies that a man might, then she might as well not be running, in my opinion. And that's not any better. So I live for the day that we do have two women on the biggest ticket in this country. But, you know, I'm also cautious about what the wrong woman can do and undo in terms of women's progress.
Yeah, and that's part of the issue that, you know, as African-Americans, we've had to deal with. Is there, I think the phrase is like of my color, but not my kind has been used a lot because we've seen African-American candidates fall into that category, too. So, but yeah, that's a whole nother show. Anyway, define the word she session.
So during the pandemic, many economists were trying to figure out what was going on at the start of the pandemic. And many of them were men trying to figure out what was happening with the economy. And I, because of my work and research, was looking at the data and looking at the numbers and noticing and observing that women were being disproportionately impacted by job and income losses and leaving the workforce at higher rates than men. In 2008, men left the workforce in greater numbers and were disproportionately impacted. And it led me to coin the term she session to describe the disproportionate impact of the economic downturn on women. And one of the things I think it's really important to say is that if I hadn't done that, if I hadn't really inserted women into our understanding of the economic downturn, we would have been likely talking about the pandemic and the economic downturn in the same terms, in the same way we were talking about it in 2008. And so it really made a difference because of my background and my research, being able to take a step back and really define and name what was happening for women and families and women of color specifically, because they were disproportionately impacted, even when we talk about, you know, women as a group.
Yeah, I think that's very important. It was one other thing I wanted to mention. When I was a legislator, I remember I was introducing bills to deal with gender pay equity. Well, I'll get to that later. I want to talk to you about intersectionality and why it's important in the discussion of improving the lives of women in America.
So, you know, fortunately, I was able to work with some really great scholars at the beginning of my career who helped to define intersectionality and introduce it. And so I felt very fortunate. And it's been actually the way that I have done my research, because I really think that when you're talking about a social issue, whether it's racism, women's issues, reproductive health and rights, if you are not thinking about the ways it's impacting different groups of women and different people, then you're missing a piece of the puzzle. So for example, if you're going to be talking about police brutality and racism, if you leave out the fact that women are a part of that conversation around over policing and police brutality, then when you come up with a solution, you're not going to really come up with a solution that is going to get to the most of the people who are impacted by an issue or a strategy. And so intersectionality for me is where we should start the conversation when we're thinking about any kinds of issues. And for people who don't know what intersectionality is, it is really looking at the impact of race, class, gender, sexuality, religion on the impact on people's lives. So how do all those things intersect to inform my experience with the system, in anything. So I'm sorry, I'm trying to explain it in a very simple, non-academic way. But for me, I live at the intersections as a woman of color. And so when I'm thinking about an issue, that's the lens that I lead with, because I can't separate out my race from my gender, from my class. All those things are operating at the same time. I'll give you another example. This is what makes intersectionality easy. I had to put back on my intersectionality hat. So if you are at night walking in an alley and someone's approaching you, when you see them, you take everything in. You take in their race, you take in their gender, you take in both those things at the same time. And you make a decision about what you're going to do in that alley in that moment. And that's what intersectionality is. It's taking all those things into account at the same time and not just thinking about or considering one thing, because when you look at just one thing, you might not be seeing the whole picture or, of an issue.
How can the current fight for reproductive rights help women overall?
Well, so one of the things I like in terms of the current framing around reproductive rights and justice is that it really is about democracy. It really is about power, and it really is about control. And so when I think about the reproductive rights and democracy, we all know that everybody should have freedom and control over their own bodies. And that's guaranteed in the Constitution, full stop. And so when women lack reproductive health and rights and autonomy, they have less control over their bodies when they start a family, their reproductive care. And so we need to make sure and ensure that women, those rights and that bodily autonomy and integrity rest with women, full stop. I think one of the issues is that people believe that women's rights, because we understand them as issues like debating the budget and or the defense budget. Everybody has a say, but in fact, everyone should not have a say. This is not the budget. This is not defense spending. But that's how we treat women's rights and reproductive health, that everybody should have a say, even people who don't have a uterus or a womb. And so really trying to reframe or talk about reproductive justice and rights as a right that women have that's not up for debate, because, we are bearers of rights under the law. And you worked at ACLU, so you know the Constitution and what I'm talking about.
How can the power and influence of American women be further expanded?
So this is what I've been up to and thinking about, future for women. So one of the things that I've been doing is thinking about where and how women have power and influence, and looking across the states and trying to understand and measure women's power and influence. And in just that short period of time, over the last couple of months, what I found is that states where women have less power and influence are states where women earn the less, have less educational attainment, are less politically active, and they don't have family or women's supported policies. So those bottom states probably won't surprise you, but that's Alabama, Mississippi, Arkansas, North Carolina, South Carolina, and Texas. And they're in the news, especially Texas, for really having regressive policies around reproductive health and some other things. And then when we look at the top five states where women have power and influence, Maryland, New York, Colorado, California, and Oregon, those are states that are expansive for women. Women have high levels of educational attainment, they're involved politically. The policies, the public policies in those states are also really very expansive and support women and support families. So there's a real direct contrast in states where, policies are hostile to women and states where they are supportive. And women are in power actually in those states as well, where we see really positive outcomes for women.
Yeah, and I definitely understand that correlation, although one of those states, Alabama, you mentioned, but then that goes back to an earlier answer that you gave. You know, they have a female governor, but like you said, if your ideology is based on repressing or suppressing women's rights, then you're no different than a man, right? So, you know, I agree that, you know, the correlation that the more power that you give or more women you put in power, the more issues can be addressed in that true intersectional sense, right?
Right.
So this is where I was going when I started talking about my experience as a legislator with gender pay. You know, I introduced a bill almost basically every year for Mississippi to do that. And then, you know, we didn't get it done in Mississippi, but at the national level, there was the Ledbetter bill that said, okay, well, you know, it's the law of the land that women should be paid as much as men for the same amount of work. Yet, I don't really see that happening. I don't know if the law had any enforcement in there. So the last question I'm trying to ask you is, name some public policies you would like to see enacted to improve the lives of women in America. But I guess the additional caveat is we can pass these laws, but how can we enforce them? You understand what I'm saying? It's like it's one thing to say, okay, we've got it on the books. Women should be paid as much as men. But if there's no teeth to the legislation, so in asking you the question, what policies, how do we make sure that whatever is on your wish list gets done?
Right. So I want to say that I've done a lot of work and research in Mississippi. That's a hard state to do work in and work that is. So hats off to you. And it's also very disheartening because, when you're in a state like Mississippi or Alabama, and I've done work in Alabama as well, you're trying to do the right thing. You are working on the behalf of, at the time I was working on, with rural Black women and their families, and you just see what the opposition, what they're up against. So you can have policies on the books, but you have a political culture that is racist, that's sexist, that is not, is calcified. Calcified is the right, and it feels impenetrable and unmovable. And that's the truth in a lot of states and state legislators like Mississippi, Alabama, North Carolina. So personally, I think that accountability, giving teeth to these laws, are what needs to happen. people have to be forced to comply, and there needs to be consequences when there is no compliance. Because in history, people have always responded to change, whether it's civil rights, women's rights, with renegotiation, refusal, or violence. And so, how do we answer that when we are trying to move the country towards progress? I think we don't, in addition to the policies, we need stronger enforcement mechanisms and accountability. And I think with a lot of these laws, we just don't have it, especially so if you're in an account, excuse me, a state like Mississippi, and you have something like the Lilly Ledbetter Act, that federal law depends on the states implementing, enforcing, and picking it up. And if you have a state that is hostile to said law, it's going to take a little bit more than the law to implement it. And that's the same issue around the EEOC laws or civil rights laws. We have a hard time enforcing it. And so I think enforcement, thinking about how we enforce these policies and laws are key, and holding people accountable when they don't. And which I think is hard. It's like Mississippi. I've seen it, you know.
Firsthand, I understand. And like I said, I did it for 9 years in the state legislature. So I appreciate you coming down and trying to. But give me one particular policy as we close out that you would like to see implemented at the federal and state level.
So I personally, I mean, I would like to see universal free childcare from birth to five. I think that would change the lives of families, women. It would do a lot for women's power and influence. And it shouldn't be means tested. Anybody who needs childcare should be able to access it, just like we have a public education system. We need to see childcare as a public good that anyone can access. So that's my children. I know, they're 14, they're teenagers now, but I can tell you that was even I had to off ramp work and refigure my work life because of the cost of care. Which for many families can consume up to 30% of their income or more.
All right, Dr. Mason, how can people get in touch with you? How can people reach out to organizations that you work with and just really get in touch with you to try to tap that brain of yours?
So you can reach me on all social at C. Nicole Mason. My new website is should be launched hopefully this week. And it's imcnicolemason.com. And you can reach me on LinkedIn at C. Nicole Mason. Substack. You can also subscribe to my new newsletter called The Perfect 10, where I discuss the top 10 issues bubbling up in the lives of women. And it's pretty fun. And yeah, those are the ways you can connect with me.
Well, Dr. C. Nicole Mason, I appreciate you coming on again. It's been an honor to have this discussion with you. If y'all want to know what the C is, y'all got to buy the book, Born Bright, if you want to know what the C means. Again, I just want to thank you for coming on and keep doing what you're doing. We really, really need it.
Thank you so much, Eric, for having me on your show.
All right, guys, and we're going to catch y'all on the other side. All right, and we are back. So, to close this out, I want to thank Evelyn and Dr. Mason for coming on. and sharing their stories, and hopefully y'all are encouraged by their stories, and you know, encouraged in the sense that maybe you all might be motivated, or encouraged in the sense that we know that there are some people out there doing the work, regardless of the times we're in and the challenges that they individually may have faced, right? And I think that's crucial for us to understand, because a couple of the news stories that Grace touched on, dealing with the sister in Texas, Crystal Mason, who spent time in jail for exercising her right to vote and was punished as if she had committed, you know, a more serious crime. And that whole deal in South Carolina, where the court said that district, those that map is not favorable to Black folks. But because the Supreme Court, the U.S. Supreme Court, has dragged their feet on making a decision, they basically don't have to run in those unfair districts. And that has a major implication, because one of those, the district that's in question, is the district that Nancy Mace represents. So, you know, it's not easy out here. We know that. But we still got to keep pressing. These folks are going to do any and everything. They have made it very, very abundantly clear that they're going to do any and everything to maintain their power and to make it hard on people who don't look like them, who don't think like them, and want to see our country go forward instead of regressing backwards. They're going to do everything, use every trick in the book. So we have to be vigilant. And so that's why I do my podcast. That's why I have guests on this podcast, to remind us that there are people out there doing the work regardless of what they're trying to do. And the longer that we stay vigilant, the longer we stay active, the longer we stay committed, I just believe in Chinese water torture, they're going to wear down and we're going to be victorious. Even if it's just them changing their ways, we win. And I don't plan on losing this fight. And I know a lot of times we talk about in leadership, well, if you lay the foundation, the change, you know, will eventually come. But I'm determined to make sure that this happens while I'm still alive. Because we've had too many leaders and too many people doing the work for all these years, and this thing keeps rearing its ugly head. You know, I can see the light at the end of the tunnel. I can see the finish line. And so I want to finish this race in my lifetime. I may not be the voice, I may not be the leader, but I'm determined to see it. And so with that, ladies and gentlemen, thank y'all for listening to the podcast. Until next time.